There was only one publisher Ferguson knew, only one publisher he wanted to publish with. And now that he had completed his novel, how pleasant it would have been to hand over the manuscript to his friends at Tumult Books, who again and again had told him they would go on publishing his work forever. But things had changed in the past several months, and the still-developing young company, which had brought out 12 books since its birth in the summer of 1967, was on the verge of extinction. The twice-married Trixie Davenport, the sole financial backer of the small but not invisible press, had married for a third time in April, and her new husband, Victor Krantz, who seemed to have no visible occupation beyond managing Trixie's investments, was not a lover of art, except for the art produced by dead painters such as Mondrian and Kandinsky, and advised the Tumult Angel to stop throwing her money away on, quote, useless causes, such as Tumult books. Thus the plug was pulled. All contracts for future books were canceled. Copies not already in bookstores or in the distributor's warehouse were to be remaindered, and those not remaindered were to be pulped. In the 9 months since it had been published, Prolusions had sold 806 copies. Not so many, perhaps, but by Tumult standards, a decent showing. The fourth bestseller on the list after Anne's Book of Erotic Poems, 1486, Billy's Crushed Heads, 1141, and Beau's Racy Diaries About Downtown Queer Life After Dark, 966. In late May, Ferguson bought 100 copies of his own book for $2 each, stored the boxes in the basement of the house on Woodhall Crescent, and then returned to New York that same evening to attend a crowded party at Billy's place, where all who had worked for or published with Tumult Books, along with their wives, husbands, girlfriends, and boyfriends, gathered to curse the name of Victor Krantz and get themselves snockered. Even sadder, now that Joanna was pregnant again, and Billy was working as a furniture mover to bring more money into the household, there was the inevitable moment when Billy stood up on a chair in the middle of the party and announced the end of Gizmo Press. But at least, Billy said, shouting drunkenly as the veins bulged in his neck, at least I'm going to carry on until I've published all the books and pamphlets I promised I would, because I'm a person who honors his commitments. A pointed reference to the pulled plugs at Tumult. And everyone applauded and praised Billy for being a man of his word, as Joanna stood next to him, with tears rolling down her cheeks, and Mary stood next to Joanna, with her arm around her sister's shoulder. And then Mary took out a handkerchief and started dabbing off the tears from Joanna's face. And Ferguson, who was standing close by and watching the scene carefully, loved Mary for doing that. On Billy's advice, Ferguson found himself a literary agent to handle the business of setting him up with a new publisher. Her name was Lynn Eberhard, and needless to say, she was Billy's agent as well. Not because Billy had finished another book, but because she was hoping to sign up Crushed Heads with a paperback house now that Tumult had stopped breathing. And Ferguson was heartened by her response to The Capital of Ruins, which she called a brilliant anti-war novel, in the letter she wrote accepting him as a client, and then, 2 days later on the phone, described it as a Bergman movie transplanted to America and rendered into words. Ferguson had mixed feelings about Bergman's films. He liked some and didn't like others, but he understood that Lynn considered it to be a high compliment and thanked her for her generous remark. Lynn was young and enthusiastic, a small, pretty woman with blonde hair and bright rouged lips who had struck out on her own about 1 year earlier. And as a young, independent agent with no former clients in her stable, she was on a mission to find the best of the new young writers. And at 22 years and 3 months old, Ferguson was nothing if not young. Then she started sending out the manuscript to the New York publishers on her list, and one by one the rejections started coming in. It wasn't that any of those publishers thought Ferguson's book was bad or unworthy or didn't show signs of what one of them called a remarkable talent, but the unanimous judgment was that The Capital of Ruins was so flagrantly uncommercial that even if they paid an advance of $50 or no advance at all, they would have a hard time earning back the costs of printing the book. By the end of the year, after traveling through the mailrooms and offices of 14 publishing companies, the manuscript had received 14 rejection letters. 14 straight punches, and every one of them hurt. "Don't worry," Lynn said. "I'll think of something." 2. The four youngest members of the Tangled Up clan graduated from their respective colleges in early June. Amy from Brandeis, Howard from Princeton, Noah from NYU, and Ferguson from his rural retreat near the Flatbush subway stop in Midwood. And now that the commencement exercises were over, all four of them had commenced their journeys into the future. After spending the bulk of his adolescence and all of his youth preparing for a life in film, Noah had bushwhacked Ferguson and the others by reversing course and declaring his intention to stick to the theater from now on. Film acting was a mug's game, he said, a stop-and-start mechanized sham that couldn't compare to the real sham of performing in front of a live audience with no retakes or editor's scissors to save your skin. He had directed 3 little films on his own and had acted in 3 others, but now he was saying goodbye to celluloid and heading off to study 3-dimensional acting and directing at the Yale School of Drama. "Why more school?" Ferguson asked him. "Because I need more training," Noah said. "But if it turns out that I don't, I'll quit the program, come back to New York, and move in with you." "It's an awfully small place," Ferguson said. "I know that," Noah answered, "but you won't mind sleeping on the floor, will you?" More school for Noah is not expected, and more school for Amy and Howard as already promised and planned. Columbia for both of them, along with the splendors of unmarried conjugal life, as Amy worked for a PhD in American history. But Howard had backed off from philosophy and would be studying in the classics department, where he could delve ever more deeply into the gnomic utterances of the pre-Socratics and not have to waste his time on the doltish Anglo-American analyticals currently in fashion. Wittgenstein, yes, but Quine gave him a headache, he said, and reading Strawson was like chewing glass. Ferguson understood how much Howard adored his old Greeks. The Nagel influence had been profound, far more lasting on Howard than it had been on him. But Ferguson couldn't help feeling a little disappointed by his friend's decision, for it seemed to him that Howard was better suited to art than to scholarship, and he wanted him to push on dangerously with his pens and pencils and try to make a go of it with his drawings, living off the hand that was already more skilled than the professional hand of Amy's father. And after the covers he had done for Billy, and the cartoons he had published in the Princeton Tiger, and the side-splitting tennis matches, and the dozens of other marvels he had zipped out over the years, Ferguson at last confronted Howard and asked him why school and not art. "Because," his old roommate said, "art is too easy for me. I'm never going to get any better at it than I am now. I'm looking for something that will test me, a discipline to push me beyond where I think I can go. Does that make sense, Archie?" Yes, it made sense, perhaps a good deal of sense, but still Ferguson was disappointed. As for Ferguson himself, there had never been any question of more school. Enough was enough, he announced to the other members of the clan, and sometime late that spring he found himself a job, which was precisely the sort of job his father would have disapproved of, a job that was no doubt causing him to turn over in his grave now. But Fritz Mangini, the smartest and most reliable of Ferguson's friends at Brooklyn College, had a father who ran a contracting company, and one of the services that company contracted for was painting apartments. And when Fritz told Ferguson his father was looking for another painter to join the crew that summer, Ferguson met with Mr. Mangini in his office on DeBrosa Street in Lower Manhattan and was hired. It wasn't a regular 5-day-a-week job as most jobs were, but a job-to-job situation with pauses in between, which would suit his purposes well, he figured, working for a week or two and then not working for a week or two, and the periods when he was on would generate enough money for him to eat and pay the rent during the periods when he was off. Now that he had graduated from college, he therefore was both a writer and a house painter. But because he had just finished his first novel and was not yet prepared to begin something else, his brain was exhausted and he had run out of ideas. He was mostly a house painter. Amy would be marching forward with no obstacles in front of her. But the plans of the three others were contingent on what happened to them during and after their Army physicals, which were scheduled to take place that summer. Howard's in mid-July, Noah's in early August, and Ferguson's in late August. In the event they were called up, Howard and Noah had each decided to follow Luther Bond's example and go north to Canada. But Ferguson, who was more stubborn and hot-headed than they were, had decided he would be willing to risk going to prison. The pro-war faction had names for people like them. Draft dodgers, cowards, traitors to their country. But the three friends would not have objected to fighting for America in a war they felt to be just, since none of them was a pacifist who believed in opposing all wars. They were opposed only to this war, and in that they considered it to be morally indefensible, not just a political blunder, but an act of criminal madness. They were enjoined by their patriotic duty to resist taking part in it. Howard's father, Noah's father, and Ferguson's stepfather had all been soldiers in World War II, and their sons and stepson admired them for having fought in the battle against fascism, which they considered to have been a just war. But Vietnam was something different, and how comforting it was for everyone in the large, tangled-up tribe to know that the three veterans of that other war stood by their sons and stepson in opposing this war. The Battle of Hamburger Hill, Operation Apache Snow in the Oshawa Valley, and the Battle of Binh Ba in Phuoc Thoi Province. Those were some of the names and places drifting back from Vietnam in the weeks before and after the three of them graduated from college. And as they prepared for their visits to the draft board in Newark, Howard, and the one on Whitehall Street in Manhattan, Noah and Ferguson, both Howard and Noah consulted doctors about imaginary ailments they hoped would earn them a classification of either 4F, unfit for military service, or 1Y, fit for military service, but only in cases of utmost urgency, which would spare them from having to move to Canada. Howard suffered from allergies to dust, grass, ragweed, goldenrod, and other airborne pollens during the spring and summer, hay fever. But his sympathetic anti-war doctor wrote a letter declaring that he also suffered from asthma, a chronic disease that might or might not have warranted Howard a medical exemption. Noah went armed with a letter as well, a statement from the anti-war psychoanalyst he had been visiting twice a week for the past 6 months, attesting to his patient's neurotic fear of open spaces, agoraphobia, which in times of undue stress blossomed into full-blown paranoia, and which, when coupled with his latent homosexual tendencies, made it impossible for him to function normally in all male environments. When Noah pulled out the letter and showed it to Ferguson, he shook his head and laughed. "Look at me, Archie," he said. "I'm a danger to society, an out-and-out lunatic." "Do you think the doctor believes any of this junk?" Ferguson asked. "Who can say?" Noah replied. Then, after a brief pause, he let out another laugh and said, "Probably." In his own best interests, Ferguson supposed he should have gone to a doctor himself and done something similar to what Howard and Noah had done. But as the reader will have observed by now, Ferguson did not always act in his own best interests. On Monday morning, August 25th, he appeared at the induction center on Whitehall Street with no letter to present to the Army medical staff about any real or imagined physical or mental complaints. It was true that he had suffered from hay fever as a child himself, but he seemed to have outgrown it in recent years, and the one condition he did have, which had condemned him to the status of talking mule, was irrelevant to the matter at hand. He wandered through the building in his white underpants, accompanied by a mob of other young men walking around in their white underpants. White young men, brown young men, black young men, and yellow young men, all of them in the same boat. He took the written exam. His body was measured, weighed, and scrutinized, and then he went home, wondering what would happen to him next. 3. Ho Chi Minh died on September 2nd at the age of 79. Ferguson, who was on his fourth job for Mr. Mangini since the start of the summer, heard the news on the radio as he stood on a ladder painting the kitchen ceiling of a three-bedroom apartment on Central Park West between 83rd and 84th Streets. Uncle Ho was dead, but nothing would change because of that, and the war would go on until the North conquered the South and the Americans were booted out. That much was certain, he said to himself, as he dipped his brush into the can for another swipe at the ceiling. But many other things were not. Why the letter announcing the date of his physical had been sent to him a full month after Howard and Noah had been sent theirs, for example, or why Howard had already been given his new classification from the board in Newark, 1Y. But after an equivalent length of time, Noah still had heard nothing from the board in Manhattan. It was also arbitrary, it seemed, a system that functioned with two independent hands, each one unaware of what the other was doing as they performed their separate tasks. And now that the physical was behind him, it was unclear how long he would have to wait. He was preparing himself for the worst, and throughout the summer and into the fall, he thought endlessly about prison, about being locked up against his will, and having to submit to the capricious rules and commands of his jailers, about the threat of being raped by one or more of his fellow prisoners, about sharing a cell with a violent, shift-toting con serving out a 7-year sentence for armed robbery or 100 years for murder. Then his mind would drift off from the present, and he would start thinking about The Count of Monte Cristo, the book he had read as a 12-year-old boy, the falsely accused Edmond Dantès held captive for 14 years in the Chateau d'If, or Darkness at Noon, the novel he had read in the 8th grade, with the two imprisoned men in adjoining cells tapping out coded messages to each other on the walls, or the inordinate number of prison movies he had watched over the years, among them Grand Illusion, A Man Escaped, I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, Dreyfus on Devil's Island in The Life of Emile Zola, Riot in Cell Block 11, The Big House, 20,000 Years in Sing Sing, and The Man in the Iron Mask, another Dumas story in which the evil twin brother is choked to death by his own beard. Jittery, darting thoughts hatched in the dual incubators of uncertainty and steadily growing panic. Summer had always been a time of intense work for him, but that summer Ferguson accomplished little except to read the first 4 rejection letters that came in for the Capital of Ruins. 1 month after Ho Chi Minh's death, the number was up to 7. 4. Throughout the summer and fall of that year, as Ferguson put in his hours for Mr. Mangini and pondered the uncertain future that lay before him, a man was setting off bombs around New York City. Sam Melville, or Samuel Melville, had been born Samuel Grossman in 1934, but he changed his name in honor of the man who wrote Moby Dick, or else in honor of the French film director Jean-Pierre Melville, who himself had been born Jean-Pierre Grumbach, or else in honor of no one and for no reason at all, except perhaps to dissociate himself from his father and his father's name. An independent Marxist, allied to the Weathermen and the Black Panthers, but essentially working on his own, sometimes with an accomplice or two, most often not, Melville planted his first bomb on July 27th, damaging the structure of Grace Pier on the New York waterfront, an installation owned by the United Fruit Company, the age-old exploiter of downtrodden peasants in Central and South America. On August 20th, he attacked the Marine Midland Bank building. On September 19th, the offices of the Department of Commerce and the Army Inspector General in the Federal Office Building on Lower Broadway. Subsequent targets included the Standard Oil offices in the RCA building, the headquarters of Chase Manhattan Bank, and on November 11th, the General Motors building on Fifth Avenue. But the following day, when Melville went to bomb the Criminal Courts building on Center Street, where the Panther 21 trial was being held, he made the error of choosing an FBI informant as his accomplice and was nabbed on the spot. He wound up in the Tombs in April 1970, where he organized a strike among the prisoners, which led to his transfer to Sing Sing in July, where he organized another prison strike, which led to another transfer in September to one of the maximum security facilities in upstate New York, Attica. By all accounts, Melville's growing radicalism had been spurred by the events at Columbia in the spring of 1968. On the night of the April 30th bust, the 34-year-old ex-plumbing designer turned up on campus to lend his support to the students, and in the mayhem of 1,000 swarming TPF grunts and 700 arrested students and the innumerable assaults on the green bands and white bands, Melville urged the students to push back and fight the police. With a small gang of protesters, he started hauling 50-gallon garbage cans made of tempered vulcanized steel to the roof of Loeb Library to drop down on the cops below. The younger students were afraid, not at all prepared to take part in such a reckless action, and scattered into the night. Before long, Melville was discovered by the police and dragged into another building, where they pounded him with clubs and left him tied to a chair. Some days after that, he joined up with the local Community Action Committee, CAC, a group opposed to Columbia's policy of evicting poor tenants from university-owned buildings. And at one of the CAC demonstrations in front of the St. Mark's Arms on West 112th Street, he was arrested along with several other members of the group. Columbia had lit the fire in him, and by the next year he had begun his bombing campaign throughout the city. So skillfully did he pull off the first attacks that he remained at large for 3.5 months, undetected and untraceable. The tabloids called him the Mad Bomber. Ferguson had never met Sam Melville and had no idea who he was until his arrest on November 12th. But their stories crossed with the fourth and most destructive of the 8 bombings, crossed in such a way as to alter the direction of Ferguson's life. For it was all but certain that the fit and healthy college graduate would have been classified 1A by his draft board, which would have opened the path to a trial in federal court and a term in federal prison. But when Melville blew up the Army Induction Center on Whitehall Street in early October, Ferguson still had not received any word about his classification. And when no word came for the rest of that month, nor any word throughout November, Ferguson cautiously advanced the theory that his Army records had been destroyed by Melville's bomb, that he was, as he liked to say to himself, off the books. In other words, if Ferguson was indeed off the books, then Sam Melville had saved his life. The so-called Mad Bomber had saved his life, along with the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of others. And then Melville had sacrificed his own life by going to prison for them. 5. Or so Ferguson imagined, or so he hoped, or so he prayed was true. But whether he was off the books or not, there was still one more bridge to cross before the matter could be settled. Nixon had changed the law. The Selective Service system would no longer be depending on the entire pool of American men between 18 and 26 to fill the ranks of the Army, but only on some of them, the ones who would be assigned the lowest numbers in the new draft lottery, which would be held on Monday, December 1st. 366 possible numbers, one for every day of the year, including leap year. One for the birthday of every young man in the United States. A blind draw of numbers that would tell you whether you were free or not free, whether you were going off to fight or staying home, whether you were going to prison or not going to prison. The whole shape of your future life to be sculpted by the hands of General Pure Dumb Luck, commander of urns, coffins, and all national graveyards. Absurd. The country had been transformed into a casino, and you weren't even allowed to roll the dice for yourself. The government would be rolling them for you. Anything below 80 or 100 would spell danger. Anything above would spell, thank you, Massa. The number for March 3rd was 263. No exaltation this time. No thunderbolt or electric current in his veins. No purple crocus jutting through the blackened snow, but a sudden feeling of calm, perhaps even resignation, perhaps even sadness. He had been ready to do the defiant thing he had promised to do, and now he didn't have to do it anymore. He didn't even have to think about it anymore. Stand up and breathe. Stand up and move around. Stand up and take in the world. And as Ferguson stood up, and breathed and moved around and took in the world, he understood that he had been living in a state of paralysis for the past 5 months. "Father," he said to himself, "my strange dead father, your boy will not be going to live behind bars. Your boy is free to go wherever he wants. Pray for your boy, Father, just as he prays for you." Ferguson sat back down at his desk and scanned the newspaper for June 16th, Noah's birthday, number 274, and then Howard's, which was January 22nd, number 337. Late the following afternoon, Noah hitched a ride down from New Haven, and at 7 o'clock, Ferguson and Howard met him at the West End to begin the evening with a round of drinks before going off to a celebratory Chinese dinner at the Moon Palace, just 2 blocks south on Broadway. Feeling comfortable in their front corner booth, however, they lingered at the West End and never made it to the restaurant, dining on their favorite bar's abominable pot roast and noodles, and then staying on until 2:30 in the morning, as they slurped down vast quantities of alcohol in several of its best-known forms, mostly scotch for Ferguson, mediocre blended scotch that led him on a bumpy ride to the nethermost bowels of drunkenness. But until he dissolved into a slurry, blot-out, double-vision torpor and was lugged by his two wobbling companions back to Howard and Amy's apartment on West 113th Street, where he spent the early morning hours passed out on the sofa, he remembered that Howard and Noah had ganged up on him at one point and had criticized him for a number of things, some of which he could still remember, some of which he couldn't, but among those he could remember were the following. He was a fool for not touching the money his father had left him. With help from the money he still hadn't touched, he should wave goodbye to America, cross the Atlantic, and spend a minimum of 1 year in Europe. He'd yet to go anywhere in his sorry little life, and needed to start traveling now. Forget that Mary Donahue had found her Señor Magnifico. It was talking about marriage, for even though Mary was a remarkable woman and had held Ferguson together through some rough times, they had no future together because he wasn't what she wanted or needed and had nothing to offer her. 12 rejections from New York publishers was nothing to lose any sleep over, and even if the book was rejected by 12 more publishers, it would eventually be published by someone, and the only thing that mattered now was to start thinking about his next book. As Ferguson remembered it, he had agreed with them on all their points. 6. Because he was a conscientious employee, and because he didn't want to let down his fellow crew members, by coming in late, Ferguson showed up for work the next morning at 9 sharp. He had slept for 4.5 hours on Howard and Amy's couch, and after drinking 3 cups of black coffee at Tom's restaurant on the corner of Broadway and 112th Street, he walked over to the job site on Riverside Drive between 88th and 89th Streets, a gigantic 4-bedroom apartment he had started painting a few days earlier with Juan, Felix, and Harry. The air was freezing that morning, and Ferguson was badly hungover, with bloodshot eyes, a cracked head, and an iffy gut, stumbling downtown with his face buried in his scarf, which began to reek of the booze still permeating his breath. Juan said, "What happened to you, man?" Felix said, "You look wasted, kid." Harry said, "Why don't you go home and sleep it off?" But Ferguson didn't want to go home and sleep it off. He was perfectly fine and had come to work. But 1 hour later, as he stood on a tall, expandable ladder painting yet another kitchen ceiling, he lost his balance and fell to the floor, breaking his left ankle and his left wrist. Harry called for an ambulance, and after the doctor at Roosevelt Hospital had set the bones and put the wrist and ankle in plaster casts, he looked over his work and commented, "A hard fall, young man. You're lucky you didn't land on your head." 7. Ferguson spent the next 6 weeks at the house on Woodhull Crescent, gorging himself on his mother's good cooking as his bones knit together again, playing gin rummy with Dan in the evenings after dinner, sitting around the living room with the 2 Schneiderman men on the nights when the Knicks games were on television, his mother and the pregnant Nancy off by themselves in the kitchen talking about the mysteries of womanhood. Home life, the comforts and pleasures of being at home for a little while, as he took his compulsory breather Dan's words, or simply took stock, his mother's words, and thought about what he was going to do next. Mary was gone, soon to be married to an intelligent senor named Bob Stanton, a 31-year-old assistant district attorney from Queens, someone far more settled than Ferguson would ever be. Not an unwise decision, he felt, but nevertheless an ache that would require more time to mend than his broken bones would. And with Mary gone now, there was nothing to hold him in New York, nothing that compelled him to go on working as a house painter for Mr. Mangini. For Howard and Noah had finally talked some sense into him on the night of their drunken binge, and he had reversed his thinking about his father's money, reluctantly agreeing with them that not to accept it would be an insult. His father was dead, and dead men couldn't defend themselves anymore. Whatever angers had built up between them over the years, his father had included him in his will, which meant he had wanted Ferguson to take the $100,000 and use it in any way he saw fit, with the understanding that fit in this case meant living off the money in order to go on writing. Surely his father must have known that, Ferguson reasoned. And the truth was, there was little anger left in him now. The more his father went on being dead, the less anger he felt. So little now, after a year and a half, that it was almost entirely gone. And the space that had once held the anger was now filled with sorrow and confusion. Sorrow and confusion and regret. It was a lot of money. Enough money to live on for years if he spent it carefully. And Howard and Noah had done well to emphasize the importance of that money, wisely counseling patience on the matter of Ferguson's rejected novel, which Lynn Eberhard finally found a home for in early February when she sent it to Columbus Books, a small, intrepid, against-the-grain San Francisco publisher that had been in operation since the 1950s. But most of all, understanding that the money would allow Ferguson to take the step that would do him the most good in his present circumstances. And as he languished in the house on Woodhull Crescent and looked into the blur of possibilities the money had offered him, he gradually came round to his friend's point of view. The moment had come to get out of America and see something of the world, to leave the fire behind him and go somewhere else, anywhere else. Ferguson dithered and mulled for the next 2 weeks, one by one reducing the plethora of anywheres from 5 to 3 to 1. Language would have to have the last word, but even though they spoke English in England and English in Ireland, he doubted he would be happy living in one of those dank, wet-weather places. It rained in Paris, too, of course, but French was the only other language he could speak and read with tolerable proficiency. And since he had never heard anyone say a single negative word about Paris, he decided to take his chances there. As a warm-up, he would go to Montreal for a short visit with Luther Bond, who was alive and well in his new country, having talked his way into McGill around the same time Ferguson had entered Brooklyn College. And now that he had graduated, he was working as an apprentice reporter for the Montreal Gazette and living with a new girlfriend, Claire Simpson or Samson. Luther's handwriting was often hard to decipher, and Ferguson was itching to go north, itching to go east, itching to be gone. He figured he would be walking freely on his ankle again by the end of January, which would be more than enough time to vacate the apartment on East 89th Street and prepare himself for the big move. Then, on January 1st, as Ferguson was about to take the first bite of his first breakfast of the new decade, his mother told him the joke. It was an old joke, apparently, one that had been circulating in Jewish living rooms for years, but for some unaccountable reason, it had escaped Ferguson's notice. Somehow or other, he had never been in one of those living rooms when someone had been telling it. But on that New Year's Day morning of 1970, his mother finally told it to him in the kitchen. The classic story about the young Russian Jew with the long, unpronounceable name who arrives at Ellis Island and begins chatting with an older, more experienced landsman. And when the young one tells the old one his name, the old one frowns and says a name that long and unpronounceable won't do the job for his new life in America. He needs to change it to something shorter, something with a nice American ring to it. What do you suggest? The young man asks. Tell them you're Rockefeller, the old one says. You can't go wrong with that. 2 hours go by, and when the young Russian sits down to be interviewed by an immigration official, he can no longer dredge up the name the old man advised him to give. Your name? The official asks. Slapping his head in frustration, the young man blurts out in Yiddish, Ich hab vergessen, I've forgotten. And so the Ellis Island official uncaps his fountain pen and dutifully records the name in his ledger, Ichabod Ferguson. Ferguson liked the joke, and he laughed hard when his mother told it to him over breakfast in the kitchen. But when he limped upstairs to his bedroom afterward, he found himself unable to stop thinking about it. And with nothing to distract him from his thoughts, he kept on thinking about the poor immigrant for the rest of the morning and into the early afternoon, at which point the story was released from the domain of jokes to become a parable about human destiny and the endlessly forking paths a person must confront as he walks through life. A young man is suddenly torn into three young men, each one identical to the others, but each with a different name. Rockefeller, Ferguson, and the long, unpronounceable X that has traveled with him from Russia to Ellis Island. In the joke, he ends up as Ferguson because the immigration official doesn't understand the language he is speaking. That was already interesting enough, to have a name forced on you because of someone's bureaucratic error, and then to go on bearing that name for the rest of your life. Interesting, as in bizarre, or funny, or tragic. A Russian Jew transformed into a Scottish Presbyterian with 15 strokes from another man's pen. And if the Jew is taken for a Protestant in white Protestant America, if every person he encounters automatically assumes he is someone other than who he is, how will that affect his future life in America? Impossible to say exactly how, but one can assume it will make a difference, that the life he will lead as Ferguson will not be the same one he would have led as the young Hebrew X. On the other hand, young X had not been opposed to becoming Rockefeller. He accepted his older compatriot's advice about the need to choose another name, and what if he had remembered that name instead of letting it slip out of his mind? He would have become a Rockefeller. From that day forth, people would have assumed he was a member of the richest family in America. His Yiddish accent would have fooled no one, but how would that have prevented people from assuming he belonged to another branch of the family, one of the subsidiary foreign branches that could trace its bloodlines directly back to John D. and his heirs? And if young X had had the wherewithal to remember to call himself Rockefeller, how would that have affected his future life in America? Would he have had the same life or a different life? No doubt a different life, Ferguson said to himself, but in what ways it was impossible to know. Ferguson, whose name was not Ferguson, found it intriguing to imagine himself having been born a Ferguson or a Rockefeller, someone with a different name from the X that had been attached to him when he was pulled from his mother's womb on March 3, 1947. In point of fact, his father's father had not been given another name when he arrived at Ellis Island on January 1, 1900. But what if he had? Out of that question, Ferguson's next book was born. Not one person with three names, he said to himself that afternoon, which happened to be January 1, 1970, the 70th anniversary of his grandfather's arrival in America, if family legend was to be believed. The man who had become neither Ferguson nor Rockefeller and had been gunned down in a Chicago leather goods warehouse in 1923. But for the purposes of the story, Ferguson would begin with his grandfather and the joke. And once the joke was told in the first paragraph, his grandfather would no longer be a young man with three possible names, but one name, neither X nor Rockefeller, but Ferguson. And then, after telling the story of how his parents met, were married, and he himself was born, all based on the anecdotes he had heard from his mother over the years, Ferguson would turn the proposition on its head, and rather than pursue the notion of one person with three names, he would invent three other versions of himself and tell their stories along with his own story, more or less his own story, since he too would become a fictionalized version of himself. and write a book about four identical but different people with the same name, Ferguson. A name born out of a joke about names. The punchline to a joke about the Jews from Poland and Russia who had boarded ships and come to America. Without question, a Jewish joke about America and the enormous statue that stood in New York Harbor. Mother of exiles, father of strife, bestower of misbegotten names. He was still traveling the two roads he had imagined as a 14-year-old boy, still walking down the three roads with Laszlo Flute. And all along, from the beginning of his conscious life, the persistent feeling that the forks and parallels of the roads taken and not taken were all being traveled by the same people at the same time, the visible people and the shadow people, and that the world as it was could never be more than a fraction of the world, for the real also consisted of what could have happened but didn't, that one road was no better or worse than any other road, but the torment of being alive in a single body was that at any given moment you had to be on one road only, even though you could have been on another, traveling toward an altogether different place. Identical but different, meaning four boys with the same parents, the same bodies, and the same genetic material, but each one living in a different house, in a different town, with his own set of circumstances. Spun this way and that by the effect of those circumstances, the boys would begin to diverge as the book moved forward, crawling or walking or galloping their way through childhood, adolescence, and early manhood as more and more distinct characters, each one on his own separate path. And yet all of them still the same person, three imaginary versions of himself, and then himself thrown in as number four for good measure. The author of the book, but the details of the book were still unknown to him at that point. He would understand what he was trying to do only after he started doing it. But the essential thing was to love those other boys as if they were real, to love them as much as he loved himself, as much as he had loved the boy who had dropped dead before his eyes on a hot summer afternoon in 1961. And now that his father was dead as well, this was the book he needed to write, for them. God was nowhere, he said to himself, but life was everywhere, and death was everywhere, and the living and the dead were joined. Only one thing was certain. One by one, the imaginary Fergusons would die, just as Artie Fetterman had died, but only after he had learned to love them as if they were real. Only after the thought of seeing them die had become unbearable to him, and then he would be alone with himself again, the last man standing. Hence the title of the book, 4-3-2-1. So ends the book, with Ferguson going off to write the book. Loaded down with two heavy suitcases and a knapsack, he left New York on February 3rd and traveled by bus to Montreal, where he spent 1 week with Luther Bond. And then he climbed onto a plane and headed across the ocean to Paris. For the next 5.5 years, he lived in a two-room flat on the Rue Descartes in the 5th arrondissement, working steadily on his novel about the four Fergusons, which grew into a much longer book than he had imagined it would be. And when he wrote the last word on August 25th, 1975, the manuscript came to a total of 1,133 double-spaced typed pages. The most difficult passages for him to write were the ones that recounted the deaths of his beloved boys. How hard it was to conjure up the storm that killed the 13-year-old youth of the shining countenance. And how anguished he felt as he wrote down the details of the traffic accident that ended the life of the 20-year-old Ferguson III. And after those two necessary but horrendous obliterations, nothing caused him more pain than having to tell of Ferguson I's death on the night of September 8, 1971, a passage he put off writing until the last pages of the book, the account of the fire that consumed the house in Rochester, New York, when Charlie Vincent, Ferguson I's downstairs neighbor, fell asleep while smoking one of his Pall Malls in bed, ignited himself along with the sheets and blankets that covered him, and as the flames sprinted across the room, they eventually rose up and touched the ceiling. And because the wood in that old house was dry and crumbling, the fire burst through the ceiling and set the floor of the upstairs bedroom ablaze. And so rapidly did the fire advance upon the sleeping 24-year-old journalist, translator, and lover of Hallie Doyle, that the entire room was burning before he had a chance to spring from the bed and crawl out the window. Ferguson took a pause. He stood up from the desk, pulled out a cigarette from his shirt pocket, and walked around and back and forth between the two rooms of the small flat. And once he felt his mind was clear enough to start again, he returned to the desk, sat down in the chair, and wrote the final paragraphs of the book. If Ferguson 1 had lived through the night, he would have woken the next morning and traveled to Attica with Ginelli. And for the next 5 days, he would have written articles about the uprising at the prison, the mass takeover by more than 1,000 men that shut down the facility as the strikers took 39 guards hostage in order to press their demands for reform. There was little doubt that Ferguson 1 would have been heartened by the solidarity among the inmates. Nearly everyone in the racially divided prison stood together in backing the demands. And for the first time anyone could remember, black prisoners, white prisoners, and Latino prisoners were all on the same side. The other side budged a little, but not enough to offer any hope. They rejected the demand for amnesty, they rejected the demand to replace the prison superintendent, and they rejected the admittedly impossible demand to give the rebels safe passage out of the country, even after the Algerian government promised to accept them all. 4 days of grinding, unsuccessful negotiations between the inmates and Department of Correctional Services Commissioner Russell Oswald. And for 4 straight days, Governor Rockefeller refused to come to the prison to help the two sides reach a settlement. Then, on September 13th, Rockefeller's mystifying command to take back the prison by force. At 9:46 a.m., the battalion of corrections officers and New York State troopers, poised on top of the prison's outer walls, opened fire on the men down in the yard, killing 10 of the hostages and 29 prisoners, among them Sam Melville, who was hunted down and executed at point-blank range minutes after the barrage of rifle fire had stopped. In addition to those 39 deaths, 3 hostages and 85 inmates were wounded. The yard was awash in blood. In the immediate aftermath of the attack, word spread that the inmates had slit the throats of the 10 murdered captives. But the following day in Rochester, when the Monroe County Medical Examiner looked over the bodies of the 10 dead guards, he affirmed that not one of them had been killed by knife wounds. They had all been shot by their fellow officers. In a New York Times story written by Joseph Lelleveld on the 15th, a relative of one of the slain guards, Carl Vallone, viewed the body and later said, "There was no slashing. Carl was not even touched. He was killed by a bullet that had the name Rockefeller on it." Nelson Rockefeller represented the liberal wing of the Republican Party. And until the Attica massacre, he had always been seen as a man of moderation and good sense. But in May 1973, he again confounded the world when he pushed a series of laws through the New York State Legislature that stipulated minimum penalties of 15 years to life in prison for selling 2 ounces or more of heroin, morphine, opium, cocaine, or cannabis, or for possessing 4 ounces or more of those same substances. The so-called Rockefeller drug laws were the most punitive ever imposed by any state in the country. Perhaps he was still dreaming of becoming president and wanted to show how tough he was to the tough law and order camp of the American public. But much as he had always wanted to become the leader of the free world, he had failed to win his party's nomination after running for president in 1960, 1964, and 1968, losing out to Nixon, Goldwater, and again to Nixon. But when the disgraced Nixon resigned from office in 1974, his vice president, Gerald Ford, who himself had been appointed after the resignation of the disgraced Spiro Agnew, took over as the new president and appointed Nelson Rockefeller to become his vice president, making them the only two men in American history to hold their offices without being elected by the American people. And so it was on December 19, 1974, after a 287-128 vote in the House of Representatives and a 90-7 vote in the Senate, that Nelson Rockefeller was sworn in as the 41st Vice President of the United States. He was married to a woman named Happy. "4321 is a Macmillan audio production from Henry Holton Company, LLC. Directed by Chelsea Pita. Produced by Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2017 by Paul Auster. Production copyright 2017 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.